Next Wednesday, April 4th, will make 50 years to the day since an assassin killed Martin Luther King Jr. in Memphis, Tennessee. Many people worried that the death of the civil rights leader would inflame an already tense racial and social situation in America. They were right. Riots rocked several cities, including Washington, D.C. And even after fires were out and windows were replaced, the country was not the same, nor could it be. Our guest this hour picks up at the assassination and moves right up to our time. Jason Sokol is the author of The Heavens Might Crack, The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. Jason Sokol is an associate professor of history at the University of New Hampshire. His two previous books were also on the civil rights movement. In fact, in January, we replayed our interview about Jason's last book, All Eyes Are Upon Us, about integration and its unfolding in northern cities. So it's a recent welcome back, Jason Sokol. Thanks for joining us.
All right. Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me. I didn't realize that you replayed the last interview in January.
It's one of our Friday reruns, but you get a chance to get heard again. The personal stories of hearing the news of Martin Luther King's death are gripping, and I guess I'm not terribly surprised to see that they range from people considering suicide to people considering declaring war.
Yeah, I mean, one of the striking things to me in doing the research was how diverse the responses were. So even within the African-American community, yeah, there was desperation and thoughts of suicide on the one hand. On the other hand, we want to go fight and battle. But in the white community, they were similarly diverse. I mean, some whites expressed glee and satisfaction at King's death, while others mourned and grieved for him.
Let's talk about the immediate legacy just within his own lifetime. I mean, after the Selma March in 65 and the Voting Rights Act, not long after that, Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy seemed secure. But this is 3 years later. What was going on at the time?
Yeah, his popularity was at a peak, I would say, around 64, 65, with the passage of the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act, when he was still working with President Johnson fairly closely, and where these landmark civil rights laws seem to be bringing about assured racial progress. Well, what King did was in 66, he went up to the north, to Chicago, and so he didn't, just rest idly after he had scored these large victories in the south, and he challenged structures of discrimination and segregation in northern cities in 66. And then 67, what perturbed many white Americans even more was when King spoke out forcefully against the Vietnam War. And he was roundly criticized and denounced for that. And then later in 67, 68, he began to forge what he called the Poor People's Campaign, where he was going to plan to lead a mass march of the nation's impoverished of all races, white, black, Latino, was going to lead a mass march on Washington. And that's sort of where his career ended.
One of the surprises of the book is to look at ways in which things that were planned before Martin Luther King Jr.'s death were carried out and other things that weren't. Did that Poor People's March on Washington ever happen?
It did happen. It happened in June of 68, a couple months after his death. And, there was a real leadership vacuum in the civil rights movement, which Ralph Abernathy tried to fill. Abernathy had been King's basically second in command at the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. But what I try to point out in my book is by the time of King's death, he was one of the last leaders, prominent figures in America, who was really trying to still unify a country that, as you said, was already fracturing. And so he was trying to build bridges between those who still believed in nonviolence on the one hand and black power on the other, and whites on the one hand, blacks on the other. After his death, a lot of those alliances seemed less and less likely, more and more impossible. And yeah, the Poor People's Campaign happened, but it was basically not a great success. It didn't end up bringing the attention that they wanted. There was horrible rainstorms with all these thousands of poor people camping out in tent encampments on the Washington Mall, and it was basically a sad epilogue.
For a historian, 1968 must represent a considerable challenge. I mean, the idea of the ways that events and moods and movements interlock. I mean, tracing what led to what must be extremely difficult within that year in particular.
Yeah, it definitely is difficult. And, you know, I hesitate to attribute all of the tumult in 1968 to King's death. There was plenty underway before him. There was the Tet Offensive in Vietnam at the end of January, which really started to finally turn the tide of American sentiment really against the Vietnam War. You had protests all across the globe, in Prague and Paris and Mexico City. And then 2 months after King's death, you had the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, which I cover in my book. And I actually show how the linkages of King's assassination with Kennedy's assassination ultimately helped to lead to the Gun Control Act of 1968. So there are some ways where I think you can pick out King's death sort of changing things in some real tangible ways.
Surely. For Martin Luther King himself, he had certainly considered the possibility of his murder and had said so publicly. What kinds of things did he say?
Yeah, I mean, from a very early stage, I think King really understood what kind of sacrifice he would be making. You know, he started to lead the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955-56. Even then, his house was bombed when his wife and child were inside. They ended up being okay. But even at that point, he sort of resolved to carry on, and he knew that somewhere along that journey, you know, he would probably lose his own life. And he still pressed on, and that's one of the amazing things about his career.
Truly, but the book is less about Martin Luther King himself than about the absence of Martin Luther King Jr. and what that did to the American society and the world at large. Jason Sokol's book is The Heavens Might Crack, and the subtitle is The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. We'll come back and talk more with Jason Sokol, and if you'd like to join us, we'll take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest once again, the historian Jason Sokol, writing about civil rights in the context of April 4th, 1968, the day Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. The country changed greatly, short-term and long-term, and our guest tracks just how in his book, The Heavens Might Crack, The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. You're welcome to join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions, comments, some observations of your own from 1968, if you remember it. And if you don't, maybe some questions about how we got to where we are today, because that's all covered in the book. 800-838-3760 to join by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's go a little deeper into what Martin Luther King was talking about in his final days. This is, by today's standards, kind of a Bernie-esque message, isn't it, Jason?
Oh, certainly. I mean, what King wanted from the federal government when he launched the Poor People's Campaign is amazing to think about today. He wanted a guaranteed annual income for every American. He wanted a job provided and funded by the government for everyone who wanted one. He wanted billions of dollars for more government-funded affordable housing. So, I mean, these were, you know, he was an avowed democratic socialist by this time. He said the government should stop spending money on bombs and napalm in Vietnam, and it should use its resources to help Americans who were struggling.
Now, he was in Memphis for a second time to help with the sanitation workers, who were generally older black men who were paid poorly and had little or nothing in the way of benefits and were on strike. How had Memphis Black and White responded to Martin Luther King's previous attention?
So the Memphis workers went on strike in February of 68. As you said, this was about 1,300 African-American workers who were paid meager wages for no benefits. They went on strike. The black community and white community in Memphis were, there was a lot of resentment there, especially in white Memphis. The mayor, Henry Loeb, was disgusted and offended that these city employees would go on strike, and he refused to negotiate with them. And the white community in Memphis supported and backed the mayor. And King, the local ministers brought King in to try to help. And at this point, you know, King thought that the sanitation strike made a lot of sense for him because it had a lot in common with his goals for the Poor People's Campaign. And King came in March, March 28th. He led this march, and some of the protesters behind him turned to violence. And immediately everybody started denouncing King. People who were in Memphis and also national leaders, senators, congressmen on Capitol Hill denouncing King as an agitator and a rabble-rouser.
It's interesting how that still happens in our time, where people with otherwise good intentions get together for a march, and then the people behind them begin breaking windows or trashing storefronts and things like that, and it gives the whole thing a bad name.
There are a lot of commonalities, especially with how black protesters in our own time have been denounced as inflammatory and lawless agitators and things like that. And I'm thinking about the way that some whites have denounced the Black Lives Matter movement and the black athletes who have mm-hmm. made statements during the national anthem. So I think there is a lot in common, actually, with how white society has responded to black protests.
There was a real oh wow moment in the book for me in reading about the first march in mm-hmm. in Memphis, and the fact that on that trip, Martin Luther King Jr. had stayed at a more upscale hotel and got criticized for it.
That's right. He stayed at the Holiday Inn Rivermont in Memphis, which was a new hotel that was patronized, mostly by affluent whites. And, you know, that's just where King's people had booked him for that trip. They thought he'd be comfortable there. Well, after the march turned to violence, and then King was whisked away from the march for his own safety, and they whisked him to the Holiday Inn. And then people started saying, oh, here's King, and he what he does is first he provokes violence, then he runs away, scared and frightened, runs away. And of all places, he runs away to the Holiday Inn Rivermont, where he's sort of living in luxury, and the sanitation strikers are still, working for meager wages. So King's detractors saw that as a moment of great hypocrisy, in a way.
And his response to it, though, was to stay at a different hotel the next time in town. He stayed at the Lorraine Motel, which was where he was shot to death.
That's right. And so he came back to Memphis on April 3rd, and he was set to lead another march that was supposed to take place on April 8th, which the city had obtained an injunction against that march. And yeah, what King said was, I'm not staying at the Holiday Inn Rivermont this time. I want something which more clearly binds me together with the black workers and the black community. So he chose the Lorraine Motel, which was owned by African Americans and patronized by African Americans. And that, of course, we know that ended up being a fatal decision. And he was on the balcony of the Lorraine when he was assassinated.
Historian Jason Sokol, our guest once again on the Jefferson Exchange. His book about the aftermath of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, long and short term, is The Heavens Might Crack, The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. So the April 8th march, injunction notwithstanding, did actually take place 4 days after the murder. Describe the scene, if you would.
It was an incredible scene. I mean, you know, all through the day on April 4th, one of King's colleagues in Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Andrew Young, he had been in court and he had been arguing that this march should be able to take place. And the city had said, Mayor Loeb and others in the city had said that the march presented a clear danger to public safety because of the violence that had occurred. And SCLC was, arguing that this was the right of people to protest. Well, so then King was murdered on April 4th. Then the march was allowed to take place. And so the march then became not only for the striking sanitation workers, but it became a march in King's honor. And significantly, it was a silent march. And the leaders wanted to show, great discipline, and they wanted to show also that the black community could come together in peace. And it wasn't just a march of African Americans. It was an interracial and a peaceful march, and they marched through the city of Memphis without really a word among them. So it was this great sea of mourners all in silence, marching through downtown Memphis.
A lot of the strikers and their families then left for the funeral of Martin Luther King in Atlanta. There was a massive crowd for that, both in the building and on the street. How did white leaders treat that event, though, Jason?
Well, this is interesting because, as I said, many white political leaders and journalists had been criticizing King, you know, in pretty harsh language right in those last days of his life. Well, then King was murdered, and almost instantly you could see this evolution take shape where he was starting to go from a lawless agitator to a martyr. And so a lot of white leaders wanted to go to Atlanta to the funeral and pay their respects, and some of them, delivered not eulogies, but tributes to King. But, you know, there was some differences of opinion because LBJ didn't go to Atlanta, for instance, and very few Southern congressmen and senators had a good word for King. So the white opinion was still divided after King's death, but you saw more and more leaders start to pay tribute to King.
Let's switch the focus to Washington, D.C. on the night of Martin Luther King Jr.'s murder. And Stokely Carmichael comes into the story at this point and often criticized for his rhetoric. He was not in the nonviolent portion of the civil rights movement. But what did he do on that night?
Well, on that night, Carmichael had a group of African Americans with him, many of whom were, deeply angered and distraught by King's assassination. And people were just getting word of King's assassination at this time. And Carmichael, with a group of people in tow, he went around from store to store and he asked white store owners to close down their shops in honor of King. And as the group trailing Carmichael got more and more unruly, Carmichael tried to basically keep the peace among them on that night. So on that night of April 4th, Carmichael tried to be a peacemaker. I mean, peace did not prevail in Washington, though. I mean, parts of the city were destroyed by riots. You could see plumes of smoke visible within distance of the White House and the Capitol.
There's some fascinating stuff in here where you include information from Howard University's Civil Rights Documentation Project, which interviewed three of the people who burned and looted in D.C. on that night and the following nights. What did they say about their motivations, why they did it?
Interestingly, most of them said that they didn't do it because King was murdered. They said it that, many of the people who turned to violence on that night and then the nights after that, many of them said that they had been ready to rise up for months and for years and protesting everything from black poverty in their neighborhoods to police brutality. Just in general, the living conditions were quite awful and oppressive, and that's what they are ready to rise up against. So I think certainly the death of King explains the timing of that destruction. That's why they did what they did at that moment. But a lot of these people said they were basically ready, ready to do it well before King had been shot.
We're talking about the aftermath of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination on April 4th, 1968. Jason Sokol, historian at the University of New Hampshire, has written now three books about civil rights. This one is about the aftermath, and both in the short term and in the long term, right up to our day. The book is called The Heavens Might Crack, The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. You're more than welcome to join the conversation on The Exchange. Share stories from that time, your memories of the death of Martin Luther King Jr. and the horrible year that unfolded after that. 800-838-3760 to join by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. There's a curious sentence you write in here, Jason. The distinction between riots and peace could actually appear quite blurry.
Yeah, I can see how that's curious. This was a very confusing time in a lot of the cities because pretty much every city in America that had any sizable population of African Americans experienced some sort of unrest. I mean, African Americans, many of them were angered, and there was incidents of at least, rock throwing or window breaking or overturned cars in many cities. I mean, in New York City, there were neighborhoods of parts of Harlem and Bedford-Stuyvesant, where what happened in those sort of isolated blocks, you would have to call that a riot. But then again, in New York, for instance, they didn't have to call out the National Guard to bring order. So, I mean, when you had cities like, you know, the cities that really went up in flames were Washington and Chicago and Pittsburgh and Baltimore. So compared to that, in other cities, it sort of looked peaceful. So in a way, it was all relative because you had urban America going up in flames here.
Martin Luther King Jr. himself wrote of riots in a fundraising letter for the SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, his group about this time. What was he referring to?
Well, King was, you know, he was thinking in the previous summer, 1967, which was known as the quote-unquote long, hot summer, where you had two of the most destructive riots in American history in Newark and then in Detroit in July of 67. You know, King was thinking about those riots, and he was writing these fundraising letters in the spring of 68, and he was basically, you know, telling SCLC potential donors that none of the causes of those 67 riots had been addressed. And the Kerner Commission had released its report, which the Kerner Commission was studying the causes of those riots, and it was recommending to President Johnson what to do. And Johnson acted on none of those recommendations. So King said, look, the government is playing roulette with the nation's cities. It's done nothing. And what, you know, he wanted federal government to take these specific steps to try to remedy the conditions in America's cities. And in a way, he anticipated exactly what was going to happen right after his own death.
It was not, however, the likes of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference that grew in the weeks and months ahead. I mean, at this point, the split in the civil rights movement became much more pronounced. How did the Black Panther Party, for example, do in membership and fundraising in the months after the assassination?
Yeah, I mean, the Black Panther Party, it already had something of a national profile, certainly. I mean, it had been founded in 1966 and, you know, gained strength in 1967. But the Panthers really only had, you know, local headquarters in California, in Oakland, before the time of King's death. After King's death, membership in the Panthers boomed, and in cities all across the country, African Americans formed local Black Panther chapters. I concentrate on one story of how the two brothers in Seattle named Aaron and Elmer Dixon were radicalized by King's death, and they set up a headquarters in Seattle.
And he became the focus of activism there himself. Aaron Dixon did, rather.
That's right. Aaron Dixon did, and he really traces the moment of his radicalization to King's assassination. So I think, you know, you were talking before about how can you pull out any of these various events that happened in 1968 and attribute to any single one of them some great causal meaning. Well, I think it's clear in the case of Black radicalism and the Black Panthers that it was King's death that really set off this turn to militancy among a certain segment of Black Americans.
We've already talked about some of the white reaction in the country. White racists in particular expressed some relief. You know, the horrible names that they used for Martin Luther King, they got to use once again. It was pretty grim in a good bit of the country. And a fair number of people who believe that Martin Luther King was influenced by communists, because that was still the big insult back then, to call somebody a commie. There were some differences, though. Mike Royko, columnist in Chicago, and Ralph McGill in Atlanta, a columnist as well. How did they see the Martin Luther King murder?
Well, it's interesting because both of those columnists, both of whom were very famous and very respected columnists, they both sat down to write their response to the King death, and independently they came up with the same conclusion, which is that they indicted American society and white society as a whole for King's death. You know, they said it may have been one man who pulled the trigger, and at that point, right after King's death, people didn't know who had pulled the trigger, actually. So they said it may have been one person. But really, it's all American society that is to blame, because they all had seen King being criticized and denounced and the intensity of the hatred toward him mounting and rising. And no white leader stood to stop it. Nobody stood up and sort of stopped the white resentment in its tracks. They allowed it to grow. And in that way, both Royko in Chicago and McGill in Atlanta thought that white society was itself guilty.
Flags were ordered to be flown at half-staff out of respect, but that didn't always happen. And, in fact, in some cases, other flags went up, too. What was that about?
Well, there were several instances in which Americans flew Confederate flags after King's death as a sign of their resentment toward King. It actually happened a lot over in Vietnam, where white soldiers were already adorning their bunks and their helmets with Confederate insignia. And then after King's death, you know, there was this real divide between black soldiers and white soldiers, and the white soldiers continued to sort of trumpet the Confederate symbols.
Wow, it's amazing the splits that that happened on a lot of different quarters of American society in the aftermath of Martin Luther King Jr.'s death. We'll move from that time up to our time as we continue the discussion with Jason Sokol about his book, The Heavens Might Crack, The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest once again is the historian Jason Sokol at the University of New Hampshire, writing several books about civil rights. This time he focuses on the events of the evening of April 4th, 1968 in Memphis, Tennessee, the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., and how that changed the country, short-term and long-term. His latest book is called The Heavens Might Crack, The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. You're welcome to join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We've acknowledged several times how difficult it is to assign cause and effect, particularly to events in the year 1968. It was a big year for protests on college campuses, you've already acknowledged. What sense do you have of how much part Martin Luther King's death might have played in some of those protests?
Well, I think a very large part in some protests. I mean, before King's death, most of the protests on college campuses were centered on the Vietnam War, and that's because, you know, college-aged students were subject to the draft, and because on college campuses there was great resistance, you know, and opposition to the war. What King's death did was it, you know, for a little while switched the focus back or added another focus to their protest, which was racial justice and racial injustice. So, for instance, I cover some events at Duke University where a lot of the students ended up holding a silent vigil. Thousands of students and faculty held.
Yeah, those were interesting. I hadn't heard about those before, but Duke was quite a hotbed for a bit.
Yeah, and that's a little bit surprising because Duke's reputation at this point was as a pretty wealthy and conservative Southern school and student body, but it still had its cadre of activists. And after King's death, they launched themselves, you know, they organized themselves and they held this vigil. And what they ended up, the requests and the demands of the students, they ended up wanting higher wages and collective bargaining rights for the workers at Duke, many of whom were African American. So this was an instance of you know, privileged, affluent white students trying to figure out how they could make a difference in their community on their campus and ultimately waging this protest on behalf of the workers.
Which really reminds me of the winter and spring of 2018, when a lot of people were taking part in their first protests.
Yeah, I mean, you could definitely see, you know, there's definitely some parallels. I mean, you see all the young people in the streets in March for Our Lives, and it's definitely possible to make analogies between the activism in the street that was surging in the streets in 1968 and through the 60s, and now some of it that you're starting to see surge again and in a positive way.
So, you know, the mobilization wasn't just on college campuses. There were even some acknowledgments of the world and how it was changing in the funny papers. I guess I'd forgotten about the change in Peanuts around this time. Charlie Brown and his crew.
That's right. This is when Charles Schulz decided to introduce the first black character to Peanuts, and the character was Franklin. And Schulz did it in response. He received a letter from a former school teacher in suburban California. Her name was Harriet Glickman. And Glickman wrote a letter to Schulz after King's assassination, and she said, you know, I think it's time for you to integrate Peanuts and to come up with a black character. Schulz's response was, actually what he said was that, well, I would like to do that, but I'm not going to because I'm not confident that I can portray a black character honestly and effectively without being patronizing.
So he kept Franklin fairly mainstream.
Yeah, so in the end, he, you know, more of Glickman's friends then wrote letters to Schulz and said, some of her African-American friends, and said, you know, it would still be quite meaningful to us to see a black character depicted in popular culture, a black character depicted just as a normal person, rather than being, you know, either like some hero or some convict in terms of the ways they were often portrayed in popular media. So at this point, yeah, Schulz finally said, you know what, okay, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to make Franklin.
I don't want to drop the thread on what happened in Memphis, because the strike was still on, as we pointed out, 4 days after the murder, and then 2 weeks later, a settlement. What happened?
That's right. I mean, finally, you know, the mayor of Memphis, Henry Loeb, was still continuing to be intransigent and truculent toward the workers. Finally, LBJ sent in his Undersecretary of Labor to Memphis named James Reynolds, and LBJ said, you know, this thing's got to be settled. I mean, King has lost his life because of it. And that's how many people in the nation had come to see that. And even a majority of Memphis City Councilmen sort of swung to the side of the workers by the end of the strike. And so there was a settlement in the end where the workers, they won the right to collectively bargain and to have a dues checkoff, and they reached that settlement on April 16th.
All right. Although apparently they had to go to court a few more times to threaten compliance with the agreement.
Yeah, I mean, getting an agreement and then actually enforcing its implementation were certainly two different things. But I mean, that was certainly a victory that they won in King's honor, and they saw it as such. They saw the pact that they made with the city as sort of a monument to their slain leader, and very much something that was done in his honor. And, you know, it was a victory for Southern black workers and for unionizing in the South. It was very difficult to break the sort of anti-union tradition in the South.
The book is called The Heavens Might Crack, The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. Jason Sokol is the author. Here's a call from Jeff in Ashland. Welcome to The Exchange.
Oh, good morning.
Hi.
In light of the national debate now on Civil War monuments, I know Martin Luther King has had many bridges and roads named or renamed after him. I was wondering, do you know, besides the one in the main monument in Washington for him, where are other monuments to Martin Luther King, and were there issues getting them created or displayed? What exactly was the thoughts during that time and even now?
All right. Thanks for that, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, I don't actually know where all the monuments to King are. I mean, there's certainly one in Memphis, and I don't think there was a lot of controversy over having that one. I mean, the thing that I did study and that I did write about a lot was the struggle to get streets named after King. And this was, you know, many of the Martin Luther King boulevards that exist now, well, many of those exist in black communities. But the reason is not necessarily because black communities wanted the King streets to run only through their neighborhoods. It's because when cities proposed Martin Luther King boulevards in the downtowns of cities or in white neighborhoods, the white homeowners and businesses resisted that at first. So that was a really interesting instance of this bruising struggle over King's legacy and how contested that legacy was even into the 1980s and 90s.
Well, you know, the setting of a person's memory in stone after a major and early death. I mean, we heard years after the murder of John F. Kennedy about how active Jackie Kennedy was, with some help from writers at Life magazine, about setting the Camelot theme that still hangs around the JFK White House to this day. Was there a similar effort for Martin Luther King?
Well, I mean, you know, days after King's murder, it was actually Representative John Conyers from Michigan, who's now been forced to resign in disgrace. Mm-hmm. But initially, after King's assassination, Conyers had proposed a federal holiday in King's honor, and the Congress turned it down. And he did that every year for the next decade, and they turned it down every year. You're also wondering about Coretta Scott King, I think, right, with the parallel to Jackie. Well, Coretta Scott King, you know, she wanted federal funds to build a monument in King's honor, and the Nixon administration sort of balked on that request. So his legacy was still very contested into the 70s. I mean, there were some conservatives who still thought King was basically sort of lawless in a way. But what you started to see was at the state level, states started to pass holidays in King's honor. Illinois, Massachusetts, Connecticut were some of the first ones. And then so basically you had this battle over King's legacy play out in all 50 states at different times, and then also at the federal level. And Coretta Scott King tried to keep that legacy alive. I mean, her testimony in favor of a King holiday was very significant, in which she portrayed King as this interracial all-American hero. She said Martin Luther King spoke to us all, not just whites or blacks. So she helped to burnish that image and reputation, and that's the image and reputation that I think a lot of Americans would in the end embrace.
You mentioned John Conyers introducing resolutions for King year after year after year. This is somewhat reminiscent of what was happening in the Senate with an effort to pass gun control legislation in years leading up to Martin Luther King Jr.'s death. Who was the agitator there, and how different was the effect after the assassination?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, basically since the time of President John F. Kennedy's assassination in November of 63, basically since that time, there were some leading gun control advocates, and basically the leader was Senator Thomas Dodd of Connecticut, tried to bring bills to the Senate floor, and each time Dodd tried, the bill would get stopped up in one committee or another. And actually, just hours before King was assassinated in Memphis, the Senate Judiciary Committee was having a meeting on one of these amendments offered by Dodd, and it deadlocked on his amendment. And then finally, 2 days after King's assassination, the committee actually finally voted that bill to the Senate floor.
Wow. And so did it pass?
Yeah, the amendment, predictably, the National Rifle Association opposed the amendment, and really it was a very weak amendment. All it said was that it was really banning the mail order sales of guns, and that didn't even apply to rifles and shotguns. It was just applying mail order sales of handguns, mm-hmm. And NRA was even opposing that small measure, but that was tacked on to a larger crime bill. And the larger crime bill did pass the Senate in May, and Johnson finally signed it into law. But then what happened was Robert Kennedy was assassinated in June 4th, 2 months after King. And the Kennedy assassinated added this great impetus to the movement for gun control. And so by the fall of 68, the gun control advocates were able to get a larger package passed, which was called the Gun Control Act.
So I want to move ahead in history, more close to our time. The Boondocks, a comic strip and television series, took a big leap in the imagination of Martin Luther King Jr. in 2006. Tell us about that.
Yeah, The Boondocks, which is the strip by Aaron Magruder, ran this episode called Return of the King. And this was an amazing act of imagination where the idea was that King hadn't been killed by the rifle shot in Memphis. He had merely gone into a coma. And he went into a coma until 2000,
The year 2000.
Until the year 2000, right? Was that it? Yeah.
Yes.
Until the year 2000, and he woke back up, came out of the coma in 2000, and he was revered as this hero, and he goes and tries to register to vote in the election of Bush v. Gore, and was not able to register, which was sort of ironic meaning about the voter disenfranchisement of today. And then what happened was 9/11 happened, and King made a statement on cable news that you know, we should still be peaceful, even with the countries harboring terrorists. And then King was branded as this un-American, you know, dissenter, which was interesting because it really paralleled what actually happened in his life when he spoke out against the Vietnam War. And then, you know, finally, Magruder has Martin Luther King leaving the United States and basically in disgrace and moving to Canada.
Wow. So just about a minute left here. Let's imagine Martin Luther King's imagination set loose on our time with NFL players kneeling, the president calling them sons of bitches, torches in Charlottesville, you name it.
Well, I mean, it's pretty clear what Martin Luther King would do because Martin Luther, the one thing he was committed to throughout was nonviolent civil disobedience. King did a lot more than just kneel peacefully on a football field. I mean, he paralyzed cities with massive street protests. So it's clear that he would be kneeling right there with them and that he'd be doing a lot more.
All right. It's a lot to take in the book, The Heavens Might Crack, The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. Jason Sokol tracks the aftermath of the assassination on April 4th, 1968, and everything since then, essentially. Jason, thanks for joining us once again on The Exchange.